I literally read an ad online. I was on maternity leave and I saw a thing pop up on LinkedIn or whatever, and I just clicked through and went, wow, that sounds like a cool job. Moving back to Washington, D.C. as well, I just thought, I'll give this a lash. And then I got the job.
Hello and welcome to the Insights podcast with Sean O'Rourke. My guest today is Katrina Perry, chief presenter with BBC News in Washington, D.C. and former anchor and Washington correspondent with RTE. She's been writing poetry and books from a young age, and with her experience in News Talk, Today FM and RTE, and her determination, it's no wonder she's now anchoring in front of millions of viewers in the US and globally. And Katrina, you're very welcome to the Insights podcast. I was going to say, and I'm going to say now, you are also a very valued colleague on the News at One back in my own day.
I know.
So great to see you again. Tell me this much, do you get back to Dublin or do you get back to Ireland very often?
Not really very often, not as often as I would like anyway. Maybe twice a year, three times a year. Try and do one chunky holiday where the whole pile of us come back, and then a few other little nip in and nip outs, catch up with the friends and stock up on food that you can't get in America.
Yeah, you're an old hand at Washington at this stage, having been the RTE core there. Came back, did the 6-1, and then I've gone on to work with the BBC. So what's it like this time as opposed to your previous stint there?
It's similar and different at the same time. So when I was there with RTE as the Washington correspondent, I had 3 years of Obama and a year of Trump won, let's say, and that amazing 2016 election, Hillary Clinton v. Donald Trump. This time being back, I had kind of a year and a half of Joe Biden and then that election, another wild election, and now this kind of first year and a half of Trump 2.0. So in terms of the city and seeing the transition from one administration to the other, some of that's very similar. The election campaigns were actually weirdly similar in terms of what was motivating voters. It's different in that I have two little kids in tow now, so I live in a different part of the city. Obviously, I work for the BBC instead of RTE, although in the same building. I was on the third floor with RTE, now I'm on the eighth floor, gone up in the world. But, you know, RT and the BBC are very similar, right? Public service broadcasters. You never have enough people. You never have enough money. There's always too much work and so on. But the ethos is very similar, I guess. Obviously, the BBC is much bigger, though.
We have a whole lot of interesting stuff, interesting ground to cover, Katrina, about politics. But look, let's just go right back. You grew up in Knocklyon in Dublin. And I gather you as well, you always wanted to be a journalist.
I did, yeah. I'm one of those annoying people that always wanted to know what they wanted to be when they grew up, you know. So even in primary school, I was writing poetry. Now, I use that term very loosely. Writing books, again, use that term very loosely. They're in my parents' attic somewhere. And as soon as I sort of knew what journalism was, I knew that's the thing for me. You know, while I was in secondary school, Veronica Guerin was murdered. So that had quite a profound impact on me. And, you know, just the notion of paying witness to history happening, the immediacy of broadcasting over print. I mean, nowadays with the internet and so on, I sound like an old lady, but everything's very immediate. But back when I was in school, you know, radio and TV was today and newspapers were sort of yesterday's news tomorrow kind of thing. And I remember hearing actually Brian Dobson doing an interview on Radio 1. He'd just been appointed business correspondent or something. I thought, oh, that sounds really cool to work in RTE. I'd like a bit of that, you know. And I remember writing a letter to him asking him for career advice and all of that. And it just felt this was the job for me. I also liked drama and, you know, being a broadcaster, as you know, Sean, there's this sort of performative element to it as well. And just kind of fact-finding and storytelling, just loved it.
I met Dobbo a few weeks ago and I mentioned that you were going to be coming onto the podcast. And he said, oh yeah, she wrote to me and I found the letter then when she was in RTE.
Yeah.
Did he ever write back to you?
He didn't. And it's funny because when I joined RTE and exactly that, he was clearing out his desk in the newsroom, one of the big moves in the newsroom, and he found the letter and he came up to me. I'm not sure if I was still on the News at One with you at that point or if I'd moved on to the TV desk. I can't remember. But he came up and gave me the the letter, typed on my old like petite 990 typewriter back in the day with like the keys slightly out of line, so the type font was all badly set. And my question that I'd asked in the letter, which of course I'd long forgotten about when he gave it to me, was what I should study in college. Should I do journalism, or should I do communication studies, or should I do, you know, history and politics or something like this? So he said that it triggered a conversation with him and the head of news at the time, Ed Mulhall, about, oh, what should we advise these young people to do, you know? But he never wrote back with his advice.
He never got around to telling you.
No. I'm still waiting, Brian.
Well, you know, you've done well, he's done well. You were one of three girls. Now, did that in any way affect the way you went about becoming or approaching journalism, or did it form you or shape you?
I was the eldest of three girls, so, and our house was a very girly house. My poor dad, you know, blessed art he amongst women, sort of thing. Very, very girly house, lots of Barbies, lots of make-believe and role-playing and all of that. I would say, I don't know, I mean, I never had brothers, so I don't know, although I do live with a small boy now in my house, so I can see the difference between small girls and small boys. But I would say that, or at least others would say of me, that I'm very bossy, and I kind of like to be running things, you know, and I like to be in charge, which, if I'm honest, is probably true. And I'm very sort of independent. And I think when you're the eldest child, you learn how to be strategic at a young age. If you need to go, if you want to go to the school disco on a Friday, you have to start asking on a Monday morning if you can go as the eldest. And then by the time my youngest sister would come along, she would say on a Friday evening as she's going out the door, oh, I'm off to the disco, bye. So you kind of learn to maneuver.
In the absence of any advice from Brian Dobson or his betters, you decided to head to DCU, Dublin City University, and study journalism.
Yeah, I really wanted to go to a university. And at the time, the only other place offering journalism was DIT, which didn't have university status at the time. So even though DIT was closer to me, I began the trek over to DCU to study journalism, which was a 4-year course at the time. And it was great. You know, we were making radio documentaries and TV documentaries. And we also did law and politics classes. So it gave you a very good sort of broad view of the world. Gave me opportunity to go abroad. I did a semester abroad in Boston University, which kind of gave me a good taste for America as well, because we were there when 9/11 happened. And then there's a work experience placement as well, which I did in News Talk.
And a great opportunity to make oneself indispensable, yeah.
Which is exactly what I did, because my work experience placement ran out and my job began the next day, a full-time job with News Talk. So I'm very lucky.
Did you finish out the course though?
Oh yeah, because it was the DC rather cleverly had structured it that your work experience placement was the very last thing that you did, sort of at the end of fourth year through the summer, with that exact idea in mind that you would get kept on in a job, which I did. So I've been very lucky, which is rare for a journalist, that I've never been freelance. I've been in full-time employment my entire career.
And what did you do initially when you started the placement and then moved through the system?
So I started News, when I started News Talk on my work experience placement, the station itself had only gone on air 1 month earlier. So it was very fortuitous, because you're getting right in at the beginning and no one really knows who's work experience and who's staff, because everybody just joined a few weeks earlier, you know. So I started as a researcher on a morning radio show called City Edition, which was being presented by Dara O'Brien, who then came to be a sports presenter here. So that was a really good grounding. Damien Kyberd was there presenting the lunchtime programme, and you know, he also was or had just recently been the editor of the Sunday Business Post. So there's a lot of kind of big brains going around. David McWilliams was there as well, so it was a good learning ground.
And after that it was on to Today FM and then RTE, which, you know, your arrival in RTE I think was almost derailed by an incident in a hockey match.
Oh yeah. Yeah, so at that time I was still playing field hockey, and I had been out playing a game on the Saturday against a club who I won't name on this occasion to save their embarrassment. But anyway, I played midfield and I was probably what you'd call a bit of a scrappy player. So a couple of girls on our team hadn't turned up this particular day. So we were down numbers. So you have to work a bit harder when you're, you know, outgunned on the pitch. And there was a breaking ball in the middle of the field and I went in for it low with my stick. And at the same time, a girl from the other side came in high with her stick. And her stick... my stick made contact with the ball. Her stick made contact with my face and knocked me unconscious and broke my cheekbone. So I ended up in hospital, blah, blah, blah. Not admitted or anything, just for many hours having scans and blah, blah, blah. But anyway, my face looked like Quasimodo or something. I could look down and see my lips and my chin out here. They were so swollen. And I was supposed to be, I was through to the second round of the sort of RTE selection process. So
the camera test?
The old days, you'd come in for a weekend. Yeah, and you do the camera test. So what was I going to do? I really wanted to get into RTE, but I did not look like the sort of person that, you know, was going to get in here. But I said, I'll go anyway, because I'm not going to squander this opportunity. It was so rare that RTE would take people in only every few years or whatever. So I came in, swollen face, on a liquid diet, black and blue, and sure, made for an interesting talking point and I suppose made me memorable. And I got a job anyway. It started a couple of months later.
Initially, on 2FM News. I gather you weren't too impressed.
I wasn't very happy, I'd say, Sean, because I came into RTE with all these great big dreams, you know, and at the time I was the courts correspondent and deputy head of news in Today FM. So I had quite a like big job there. And I came in here and I was on the 2FM desk. And I remember one Friday night, you know, working till midnight, reading stories about Britney Spears and stuff on 2FM. And there's, you know, if that's your lane and you're into entertainment journalism, it's fabulous. And getting a job doing the news on 2FM is many people's dream jobs. It wasn't mine, though, because I'm driven by politics and geopolitics and all of this. So I used to come into work, I don't know if you remember this, but like in a full suit every day to work on the 2FM news desk with my contacts book and everything, because I was a firm believer in the dress for the job you want, not for the job you have. And everyone else around me was so trendy and cool and I'm there in my suit, you know. But it worked anyway. So about 2 months later, then I got moved off the 2FM desk onto the News at One desk with the great Sean O'Rourke.
And you haven't looked back. I mean, what
and
I
it
recall,
all started there.
what I recall is that you were very focused and extremely reliable. No matter what you were asked to do, you always delivered. And obviously, we love to have people like that as colleagues on a show.
Well, thank you. I'll take that as a great compliment.
But just back to the point you make about dress for the job you want, not the one you have. I mean, yeah. Is that something that women more than men would have to do or should do or actually do?
I don't think so, because I think if I'd been male and I didn't want to work in entertainment journalism, I wanted to work in politics, I probably still would have been sitting there in a suit and a shirt and tie. I'm not sure, you know, if you were male and you were happy there, would you have still come in jeans and a t-shirt and trainers? I don't know.
Yeah. Inevitably, people move on and they move from desk to desk, which obviously is a good idea.
Yeah.
You got a big break, didn't you, on an assignment in Australia?
Yeah, so I had long been eyeing up the Washington correspondent job, actually, since I was in college in DCU. One of my friends at our graduation said, oh, I bet you'll end up the RTE Washington correspondent. And I said, oh, yeah, that'd be a nice one, wouldn't it? So, you know, the first step was obviously to get into RTE. And then when here, it was to get foreign experience. So after my time on the News at One, I'd moved to the TV home desk doing Irish stories. I was trying to figure out, how do I get on a foreign assignment? So the foreign editor at the time, Kathy Milner, asked me would I be interested in going to Australia, because there was going to be later in the year the trial of the individual accused of raping and murdering Jill Maher. We all remember that dreadful, dreadful case. So I said, yeah, absolutely. You know, she was similar age to myself and all of that. So I just really felt that this is a story I'll go and do justice on the story for her and her family. So with various delays in courts and so on, that took many months to come around, and the individual ended up pleading guilty, as it turned out. So it was a sentence hearing, but clearly huge interest in Ireland. So I went anyway. And there were 2 weeks or something, I think, between the court dates when I was going to be there. And, you know, RTE always keen to maximise the budget on these things. It was, well, what else can you do while you're there? So I said, I'll do a series for Nationwide and The 6-1 and Morning Ireland on the Irish in Australia. OK, well, we've no money for a camera person to go. Fine, I'll VJ it, I'll film it myself, which is what I did.
VJ being video journalist.
So you're doing the camera and everything yourself. So got my little camera, my kit, and off I went to the other side of Australia and did the court dates, and then also did a 3-part TV and radio series on the Irish in Australia, which then also became a full nationwide special. The Lions tour was on as well while I was there, so I headed up to Brisbane for that and did a few bits and bobs for sport while I was there as well. So I really am, I suppose, juiced the opportunity, because, you know, when you work in a large organisation like RTE, there's many talented people, it's very competitive, and you're always looking for when is your chance or your break going to come. And for me, this was it. So I knew the Washington correspondent job was going to come up later that year. So I sort of said, well, this is my blank canvas to show if you send me to a different continent by myself, I can do all these things.
And meanwhile, I think you had taken some steps on the academic side to boost your qualifications.
Yeah, so I'm a firm believer, if you want something professionally, you know, fill your toolkit up, right? So when you get to the interview, especially if you're coming at it, not at the time I would have been considered quite young to get the Washington correspondent job. So you're up against like very seasoned colleagues. So I said, I'm going to fill my toolkit. I need to get radio and TV experience. I need to show I can do things abroad. I also then went back to college to do a master's in international relations while I was on the News at One, because, you know, that day starts very early, as we remember, and finishes early. So you do have afternoons and evenings to do college courses. So I did my master's in international relations. I also learned Spanish because I figured that that would be very useful, which it turned out to be, living and working in America. So I had my eye very firmly on an end goal, and I wanted to make sure that when I got to the interview, there was nothing that I was lacking or that wasn't in my control, except, you know, small p internal politics, which is always the way as well. And there's nothing you can really do about that on the day other than make yourself be the best candidate.
And so it turned out to be. You were the successor to Richard Downes. I mean, and RTE, I think, has had a firm policy from the outset in the mid-90s when Mark Little went there first, of rotating. You generally don't get a second bite at it.
No, you don't. It's 4 years. It's fairly set like that with all the farm postings, London and Brussels as well, at the time. And Tony Connolly sort of there predates that system. So he's been there for longer. But I mean, it's fair, because otherwise there aren't, you know, we don't have a huge, there isn't a huge, you know, foreign correspondent deck in RT. So that keeps it rotating. So I had my 4 years, but Richard had left a bit before me because Nelson Mandela was very ill and about to die. So he'd been relocated to South Africa,
where he'd been with the BBC many years earlier. Yeah. So how did you find it? I mean, did it live up to your expectations and your dreams?
Oh, yeah. Oh, and more besides. It was a spectacular time. You know, I was in my very early 30s. Myself and my husband went over there, and we just had the most tremendous adventure. And, you know, especially being there in the Obama years, which I remember you'd be phoning up saying, oh, President Obama's about to do blah, 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 whatever. Do you want a story on that? It's like, oh, no, presidential process stories. Who wants those? I mean, we look back and laugh now, because so much of what we do is a presidential process story on whatever Donald Trump is doing. But it meant that I had great leeway to travel all around the US, which, you know, my successors haven't had the same opportunity because COVID happened and the story's in Washington now. So I got around sort of 42, 43 states. It was fabulous.
And one of those was a particular Irish story, a tragedy. That was the one where the students were on that balcony that collapsed and many fatalities.
Yeah, and that was very, very difficult story. I hate even calling it a story because it's a tragedy, right? And for those families who lost children, I mean, they were kids, or badly injured, you know, it's just something you never move on from. And I don't really like even talking about it at all. And I haven't before now, because I just feel my experience of it, as sad as it was, pales into complete insignificance compared to what those families and friends and everything went through. But I had just come back from Jeb Bush, remember him, announced his candidacy for the presidency in Florida the day before. And I had just come back from their really late flight and got into bed. And then I got a phone call like 3 hours later going, get to the airport. You have to go to San Francisco. This awful thing has happened. So you just, you know, you can't have a go bag as a foreign correspondent. So I just grabbed that, made sure to put in a lot of black and white clothes. And off I went, not knowing what I was going to kind of find when I got there. And, you know, I, because of proximity, obviously got there before the families did or the friends of the other young people who were there. So there was a real sort of, I mean, the singular tiny positive was the swelling of the Irish community in America, just wrapping their arms around all these people facing the worst, worst possible thing that can happen.
Yeah, and the aftermath, as you say, is something many years, over a decade on, those families and survivors are still living with. And I suppose as well, there would have been other stories, maybe not as dramatically touching you in the sense that they wouldn't have had an Irish connection, but some of those, you know, multiple shootings, for instance.
Yeah, it's funny. You kind of find an Irish connection in every story in America. Mm. My colleagues at the BBC now, it's a running joke because everyone that comes into my studio to be interviewed, I find the Irish. You know, it's a real sort of Irish mafia scene in the US. But yeah, I mean, it's an unfortunate aspect of American society that it's almost been normalized now, these mass shootings. So when I was there, the Pulse nightclub shooting happened in Orlando. A shooting happened at a country music festival in Las Vegas. And again, you're getting a phone call in the middle of the night, or I'm ringing the desk here in Donnybrook saying, this thing's happened. I think we need to get on a plane and go. And then you just land into this sort of centres of extreme grief and trauma because all the family members and relatives are coming to this place. Sometimes, depending when you arrive, you know, the bodies are still there. And it's just a scale of loss that is very hard to comprehend anyway for any human, you know, but especially when you come from this part of the world where everyone's not walking around carrying guns and this isn't so normalized, and oh, we must do something about gun control, and then nothing really of note happens.
As you say, you had, I think, was it 3 years of Obama and then about a year and a bit of Donald Trump won. Unlike a lot of people, I think you saw the Trump victory coming, did you, in 2016?
I did. I'm on the record as predicting that he would win, actually, which, you know, has a lot of people now think I give good tips for things. It's like, well, I predicted it then, and I also predicted it this time around as well. Again, on the record doing so, I said it on Drive Time on one occasion. Somebody who was on a panel with me sort of went, oh, you're high, it's never going to happen. And I said, well, we'll see. Because traveling around the US, and this is the thing with journalism nowadays, right? So much of it is budget cuts and people not getting to get out to where the story is. And it's so important because when you travel around, as I did 2016 and 2024, speaking to the voters, not at the big rally sites and so on, you really get a sense of what's motivating people. And it was the same. It was a deja vu situation in 2016 and 2024 in terms of what people were saying was motivating them. And it was money. I mean, it's the economy, stupid. You know, it's the same with elections here in most countries. People want to know who's going to make my life better. And people were saying the same things to me 8 years apart about feeling left behind, feeling that politicians didn't understand them, worried that they were working at certain jobs, but they still were struggling to make ends meet no matter how many hours in the week they worked. They couldn't feed their kids meat more than once a week. You know, they couldn't put fuel in their car. Thoughts of buying a new car were pipe dreams. Thoughts of taking holidays, not going to happen. And, you know, a sense that Donald Trump might do things differently, which was one thing in 2016. But then when you get to 2024, January 6th has happened, and the president in the first term is twice impeached, and people still felt that they could set all of that aside because Donald Trump would offer them a way out of this cost of living crisis.
Even the first time around, you know, the damaging revelations that came out about his attitude towards women, for instance, didn't seem to have any effect at all in a negative way.
No, and it was amazing the amount of people said to me both times, you know, I don't really like him as a person. I don't want him coming to my house. I wouldn't want my daughter bringing someone like him home to marry or whatever. But I really want him as a president. He's a very successful business person and I don't really care about the rest of it. Mm. I'm just interested in someone who can make change.
Now, between those two elections, there was an interlude, and I just want to talk about it now, where you came back and you were assigned to the 6-1 with our late and much loved colleague, Kieran Shanley. Yeah. Was that a big adjustment for you coming back to Ireland?
It was massive, Sean. It was massive. I mean, when I was coming to the end of my fixed post term in Washington, I was thinking, how do I find a way to stay here, actually? And I had negotiated a bit of an extension with our then boss, John Williams, to stay on a little bit because Donald Trump was, you know, so different, so seismic. And he was very aware that I had sort of this institutional knowledge and contacts that would be beneficial to RTE. But then everything's about Dabo, isn't it? Brian Dobson said he was leaving the 6-1 to go to Morning Ireland. So then I got a phone call on my way into the White House one day from John Williams saying, I want you to come back when your term is up and do the 6-1 and do it with Keelan. And it's like one of those Tom and Jerry cartoon moments where a klaxon starts sounding in your ears. What? What? I've never made any moves towards being a presenter before. This is wild. And, you know, the 6-1 is obviously such a big job. It's such an important part of Irish public life. So I felt I couldn't turn this down. So I didn't. So at the end of my term, I came back into the 6-1 studio with the amazing Kieran Shanley, who, as you say, unfortunately is not with us anymore. And it was amazing to work with her because I was a total novice presenter for all my years and air miles as a correspondent, and nothing would faze me in that situation. It's very different, as you know, Sean, going from being a correspondent to a presenter. It's a different way of thinking and behaving. It's a different skill set entirely. But I had Kieran beside me, who was just the most fabulous and generous colleague. So, you know, we had a great, great time of it. Personally, it was a major adjustment because I was living this seriously high octane sort of dramatic life in Washington, and then coming back to being in the studio day in, day out, whereas when you're a correspondent, you're in a different place every day. So and that took a lot of getting used to.
But I suppose, again, it was a bit like, you know, learning the Spanish and doing the masters. It gave you a new and a very important tool for the toolbox when it came to your next big career move.
Yeah, well, I would never have got this job had I not been doing the 6-1, you know, because that gave me the air miles again, and COVID happened. So I ended up doing hours, as we all did, of live broadcasting, waiting on government announcements, filling the airtime, which is the big key skill of a sort of rolling news live presenter, that you can just talk for Ireland for many hours if you have to. And so, yeah, when this job came up with the BBC then as one of their chief presenters on the Global News Channel, to be based in Washington, D.C., I thought, wow, what a cool job.
And now, had you gone foraging for an opportunity with them, or did you just happen to read an ad online or something?
I literally read an ad online. I was on maternity leave and I saw a thing pop up on LinkedIn or whatever, and I just clicked through and went, wow, that sounds like a cool job. And it's a good mix of studio presenting with a massive global audience and, you know, some traveling, being out in the field, all this extra stuff, and the opportunity to work with people who, you know, I sort of think are the Galacticos of what we do, who I've grown up watching, like our fellow Irishwoman Orla Guerin, Fergal Keane, Jeremy Bowen, Lise Doucette, all these sort of household names of foreign correspondency and international journalism, and to have the opportunity to be alongside them moving back to Washington, D.C., as well. I just thought, I'll give this a lash. I'm on maternity leave, like, you know, my brain is elsewhere entirely, but sure, we'll see what happens. And then I got the job.
Was it a rigorous assessment process that you had to go through?
Yeah, it was many, many rounds and screen tests and interviews with this, that and the other person all the way up to the top. Because you are representing BBC News, the brand. And, you know, outside of the UK, where you're watching the 6 o'clock news, 10 o'clock news, whatever, outside of the UK, the BBC is a global brand, and it's the news channel or World Service Radio that people are watching and listening to. So it's a, like, they think long and hard before they make those appointments, because you're one of the faces of the BBC globally.
And how many million people would you be broadcasting to at any given time?
Could be 120 million people. Which is like,
that's a big number.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Yeah.
So you've got, as you say, Trump 1 and Trump 2, the different periods. I was reading something in the last couple of days which suggested that Trump 1, you know, in his first term was more controllable from the point of view of people working with him, that he was prepared to listen, and there were people who were prepared to say, Mr. President, I wouldn't advise that. Whereas now he's basically surrounded by people who agree with him and who basically want to pander to his ego and are fearful of contradicting him. Would you say that is a fair analysis?
No, probably not, actually. I think Trump won. He had, yes, a lot of more established tradition conservative Republicans with him who had worked in past administrations and so on. But a lot of those left because, you know, they were trying to say, oh, this is not the way we would do it, or this isn't a traditional Republican platform area. And then he was like, well, that I'm not a traditional Republican. So they would left, they would leave or be fired and so on. I think now, yes, he has people around him who will do what he says, but that's sort of the way of any leader, right? But he also, because he didn't win in that 2020 election, there's a whole cadre of people who spent those 4 years getting ready for these 4 years, who have a certain belief system that the president goes along with to a degree, and wants to facilitate. And those people spent those years, because I've spoken to them, going through the statute books, going through the constitution, finding the grey areas where they could stretch presidential power, knowing that it would ultimately end up in the Supreme Court. But he had stacked the Supreme Court by virtue of the way things fell during his first presidency. So they had a confidence, a whole team of people, that they would be ready to effect maximum change on American society as soon as they got into office. And that's not all Donald Trump. I mean, he did not spend those 4 years crafting various policies and draft legislation and so on. So, you know, I don't think it's all him. But I mean, ultimately, he is the president, right?
Yeah, I suppose the suggestion was put forward in the context of the war that's been going on for several weeks now against Iran. And just to quote an official saying, inside the administration, some people are getting pessimistic about the lack of a clear strategy to finish the war. But they have been careful not to express that directly to the president, who has repeatedly declared that the military operation is a complete success. Now, the idea of being careful not to speak the truth to the president and to call it as you see it, that has to be a matter of concern.
I mean, if we're talking specifically about Iran, nobody really knows what the outcome there was at the start of it. Most unusually that a president would not sit down and do a live address to the nation before taking the nation into war. And even the president began talking about it as a war and then was talking about it as a small excursion and then a military operation, you know, changing the language as he's getting nearer to a place of declaring a victory. And I think, you know, they sacked so many people within the Pentagon, within the Department of Justice, long-term civil servants, that they don't have that sort of check on power that you might expect from civil servants in there.
Yeah, and again, the point has been made, the one thing that Donald Trump claims not to have been told about by advisors was that the Strait of Hormuz would be closed and that would have massive consequences. A president of the United States goes into war without knowing that?
Well, I mean, this is the one of the major grey areas in this administration, because I have spoken to people who are in the administration and in his past administration and in other administrations who say, you know, there are briefing files that say, even speaking to one man who was negotiator with Iran in the Obama administration, they knew this would happen. Like, this has been gamed out for a long time in the State Department and in the Pentagon. And people say they did give the president the briefings. Now, did he choose to not read them, or did he read them and is choosing not to say he read them? You know, we don't know. But the information that if you poke Iran, this is what they will do, they will go for the Strait of Hormuz, definitely was there.
As you say, the question is, did he read it, or was he listening carefully enough when he was spoken to about it? Is it possible for you, Katrina, just given the mercurial nature of this president, is it possible for you to know what to believe at any given time?
It's very hard. I mean, it's very difficult because people are briefing and counter briefing. And it was the same in Trump 1. There's a lot of interpersonal stuff at play and jockeying for position and so on. And, you know, that does go on inside every administration. People want to be the preferred son or whatever, you know, within a group like that. But it is very difficult because the president, particularly on Iran, says different things day in, day out. And his position changed, particularly in the early days, day in, day out.
And the suggestion is floating around in quite a lot of places and in a lot of analysis that his vice president, J.D. Vance, is not at all on board with this idea of, you know, from the start of attacking Iran.
No, and he's on the record, J.D. Vance is, of not being in favour of it. And, you know, in a couple of days before the war began at the end of February, he was doing interviews to that effect, and we'll exhaust the diplomatic process and etc, etc. He's extremely sceptical of the whole thing.
Yeah, and I'm wondering as well, I mean, this suggestion that, oh, it's preposterous to think that the tail would have wagged the dog, as suggested by Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State, that it was only because Israel were going to do it anyway that the Americans joined in. Implausible, but is it possible that actually that is what happened?
I think it's very possible. I think a lot of people put a lot of weight in what Marco Rubio says, because he obviously has a long history of being an elected politician and, you know, of being, he made those remarks initially about Israel while he was on Capitol Hill going in to brief some of the senators there, a former senator himself, of course. So a lot of people put a lot of weight in what he says, and I don't think he would have said something that sort of potentially inflammatory if it wasn't true. You know, why would he have said it if it wasn't true? Because it's a slightly crazy thing to say if not true.
But it does speak to, I suppose, just the strength of the Israeli influence in the United States.
Oh yeah, I mean, that's beyond question at this point. And, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu had been over in the White House just a few weeks before the war was launched. I was there that day, and unusually they didn't do a big press conference together, but he was in there for hours. So the Prime Minister and the President were obviously having very serious talks about something. I mean, we can only deduce now that it was Iran.
And it's been reported as well that Netanyahu had been persuaded by the Israeli Secret Service Mossad that the Iranian administration, or that that the leadership was there for the taking, and they could be knocked out fairly easily. But that has had to be revised, if that in fact was, and that in turn Netanyahu persuaded Trump that this was a great opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, that's some of the reporting, again, from the immediate days, that they had been talking about this, and then Netanyahu sort of rang Trump and said, look, we've got an option here on Friday night into Saturday morning. We should take this. This is it. And Trump seemingly agreed. I mean, that's when the strikes began. And as we know now, the Ayatollah then was killed that day.
So from your experience, Katrina, in Washington, and, you know, you're just back in Ireland for a few days, do you get any sense that, you know, people are fearing that they're getting deeper and deeper into a quagmire?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no public support in the US for this war. You know, there's polling out from wherever source you want to look, all puts the disapproval rating for this war, the lack of support for this war, in the sort of 60, 70, 80% mark. So the majority of American people, again, polling, pinch of salt, blah, 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 but they're all showing the same thing. So, and even talking to people as well, you know, it's a nuanced position in a way that nobody wants to say that they were pro a regime that treated its own people the way it treated them, that they don't want a country having a nuclear capability to be able to hit the US. But there was no evidence showing that that's what the threat was. Indeed, quite the opposite, because the president and everyone talking about how they'd obliterated that particular threat from their strike in June 2025, the Operation Midnight Hammer.
When you look at what's going on in the Middle East, be it in Lebanon, Gaza or Iran, you look at what's happening in Venezuela, which does seem to be under control from an American point of view. Look at Cuba, where very serious things are happening as a result of the blockade. Then there's Ukraine, and you know, sort of back behind us is the suggestion that America wanted to take over Greenland. I mean, do you think there is a grand plan in there somewhere?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and they've stated it, you know, particularly around Greenland, Cuba, Venezuela. Like, you know, it's our hemisphere. The Western Hemisphere is ours, and we won't sort of settle till we're in control here for national security purposes, for economic purposes, for global dominance. There is most definitely a strategy there.
But might there be a danger as well in trying to execute that strategy of triggering a massive global recession?
Absolutely. And, you know, again, going back to polling, the majority of American people now think there will be a recession this year. And, you know, depending how long oil prices continue to rise, how long it takes them to reset, the impact that that has on inflation. You know, the problem with fertilizer, it's not just oil and gas in the Strait of Hormuz, but problems with fertilizer. Three of the top five countries that supply part of the, you know, fertilizer component to the US are in the Middle East, can't get their materials out. So that has a knock-on impact on produce, on inflation in the US, on an already pretty tough cost of living crisis.
So how can they face into the midterm elections that are coming up in, what, 7 months' time?
Very,
a little more?
With great difficulty. With great difficulty. And, you know, that's giving Democrats a bounce in their step, which they already had from some of the special elections that we saw towards the end of last year. It's making a lot of Republicans extremely nervous. You know, the one thing people said in 2024, as we were talking about earlier, is cost of living, affordability, who's going to make things better for me and my family. And now you're the guy that you put your faith in actually has made things worse. Like, grocery prices are up, inflation has not come down. And the one win that President Trump had in his first year was bringing down the price of gas, or petrol, as we would say. And that's rocketed back up. And so, you know, that's something that's, again, hitting people in their pockets. They don't understand, by and large, why America has started this war, what is for America to gain, where it's going to end, how it's going to end. So that's making Republicans really nervous.
To what extent, though, have the Democrats got their act together in terms of what they're offering by way of an alternative? Because there are many voices.
Yeah, there are. And midterms are different to presidential elections, as you know, in that they don't actually really have to have one singular voice in a way, because similar to our own elections, people will vote for the guy or gal in their constituency personally for what are they going to do here as part of a bigger bloc. So they don't need to have the same singular message that they need to have for the presidential election. And I think they're in big trouble there for 28, because there isn't a single message or a single person to deliver it. But I think, you know, I'm not one of these people that subscribes to the view that it's going to be a complete massive victory for the Democrats in the midterms. I do think the Republicans will still hold on, but it's a game of tiny margins, you know. And we still
have... You mean to hold on and control both houses?
Potentially. I mean... Potentially. It's too far out, and I haven't travelled around enough yet this year, but mostly it's too far out. People make up their minds August, September. If we're still in a situation then where petrol price, gas prices have gone through the roof, where it's affected home energy prices, because remember, in the US, you don't have to just worry about the cost of electricity and gas in your house from kind of November to February or March as you do here, because you stop heating your house, you turn on your AC. So your household gas and electricity bills are year round. So it's not a case of, you know, as it might be in Ireland, if I can suffer through the winter, then I don't have to kind of turn the heating on.
And meanwhile, we've got these stories coming out about, I suppose, reflecting Trump's ego stroke vanity. I mean, the idea, for instance, that he wants the coin to mark the 250th anniversary of the United States to have his head on it. His signature, unlike any of his predecessors as living presidents, is going to be on the currency. You have the Trump Kennedy Center. I mean, like, you know, how low do you go?
Knocking down a bit of the White House, you could add to that list as well, you know, to build back up a glorious ballroom. We know he likes putting his name on things. He's got a great history of doing that as a developer. And, you know, that really annoys people. But what was surprising to me, because I think if somebody tried to knock down part of Leinster House, for example, or Oras an Uachtaráin, like, the streets would be lined with people protesting about that. And that just hasn't happened.
Mm. Another thing about him, though, is his capacity to bob and weave. I mean, we were talking about how he says things, you know, a week or a few days apart that contradict each other. But I mean, for instance, when we saw what happened when ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement people, went in huge numbers, 3,000 in Minneapolis there at the start of this year. Two people got killed, Rene Good and Alex Pretty. He managed to kind of call off the dogs, as it were, in a way that calmed things down.
Well, he did that by making a head roll, basically, you know, and I won't say firing, but removing along his Department of Homeland Security Secretary, Kristi Noem, to give her this new job, Special Envoy of the Shield of the Americas, to our earlier point about the Western Hemisphere dominance. And then, you know, removing as well the sort of head commander guy who was on the ground in Minneapolis, and putting in Tom Holm and his border czar, who has worked under many administrations, Democratic and Republican. So he was able to take the temperature out of that and somehow make it seem like they weren't his policies, that it was Secretary Noem's policies. So, you know, I mean, Donald Trump is a master messenger and a master marketeer. And he does, I think quite strategically in that way.
Is he as intellectually and cognitively sharp now as he was in his first term?
I can't really answer that, because I'm not in those private meetings, you know, with him and his advisors or his cabinet. And, you know, he delivered kind of, you know, the great weaving speech in his first term as he does now. So I couldn't really speak to that one.
On a personal level, have you had any direct contact with him? I mean, there was that famous stroke, infamous occasion. Yeah. I think during his first term, he summoned you over to the desk when he was on the phone, I think, to Leo Varadkar back here, and talked about your nice smile and that kind of thing. I mean, like, it was, what's the word I'm looking for? Not gross, but it was improper, I suppose you might say. But probably didn't do any harm for your reputation. A lot of people knew that you existed previously mightn't have known that was the case.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Because, you know, at the time, obviously, I was working for RTE, which is not the same as the BBC. So, that did lead to me getting stopped in supermarket queues and stuff in Washington, D.C., because it was on every network there. But I mean, those kind of moments are nearly 10 a penny now, aren't they, with Donald Trump?
He's been doing a lot of one-to-one interviews. I mean, particularly since the war started on Iran. I mean, would you hope, or have you sought to get a one-to-one interview with him?
Yeah, hopefully that will come to be. I don't want to talk too much about it lest I jinx it, but he is very available to the media. In a way that predecessors haven't been. He does favour, for obvious reasons, US networks and so on. But, you know, he likes to talk, and he likes to be talked about and to be in the media. And just, I mean, the best way from his perspective to be in control of the narrative is to be in control of the narrative and have it come out of your mouth. So, I mean, it's remarkable. Sometimes he takes questions from journalists 3 times a day, which, you know, definitely was not the case under Joe Biden, and even wasn't under Barack Obama either, where they just tend to be more careful about what they say and when they say it.
How many hours a week do you work?
Oh, God, I don't know. A lot.
I mean, would it be kind of heading up towards 70 or even beyond that?
I mean, it depends what you define as work. It was funny.
Well, being in the office, being on air, reading, making phone calls.
But this is what I mean. Like, you know, as a journalist, and actually I think back to our time on the News at One, and you were doing the week in politics on a Sunday as well. Like, you're not actually ever off when you're covering politics. And, you know, I remember when we were working together in the height of the period leading up to the bailout, and ministers were resigning, the IMF was coming in. Like, I do remember looking at you being, oh, he never stops working. So it's kind of like that, even though you're not on air the whole time, the pace of the news cycle is just wild. And, you know, even being in Ireland for these few days, you're kind of like, what's going on? What am I missing? You know, texts and calls and trying
to
keep
up. How long do you think you'll be able to stick that pace?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, that's a thing, you know, all of us fellow journos in Washington talk about all the time, because it's completely exhausting. So, yeah, who knows?
Would you intend or aspire or hope to maybe come back to Ireland to work here again, or maybe, you know, go to London?
Yeah, who knows? I mean, the story is in Washington right now and I'm in the middle of it. So, and, you know, I'm doing it for like the biggest broadcaster in the world, and it's just amazing to be part of that. I don't have a job in Ireland anymore. You know, if one came along, we'll see. We'll judge it based on opportunity and so on.
Would you fancy something like the Late Late Show?
Always looking for the line. Well, there's no vacancy there, Sean.
No, but I mean, it's apart from one or two exceptions, you know, on the night, it's never been presented by a woman. It's the kind of thing, but your all of your experience and your profile would maybe qualify you to do.
Maybe. I'd never thought of it, to be honest. You know, who knows?
Just keep your eye on LinkedIn. Maybe you
yeah,
never know.
Keep my eye on LinkedIn.
You were saying a few minutes ago, Katrina, finally, that you thought the Democrats could have trouble finding a suitable candidate who would unite the party and the supporters. What about the Republicans? Does it come down to a choice between J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio? And if so, which of them?
Well, I'm not that silly at this point anyway. You know, at this point in time, that it looks like that's what it is. The tradition would always be the vice president of the day gets dibs on it. So even for Rubio to be in the conversation is kind of offensive to J.D. Vance in a way. But, you know, President Trump does speak very glowingly of Marco Rubio, who obviously is the Secretary of State, but also the National Security Advisor. So he's in the middle of a lot of what's going on right now. But my gosh, it's a long way off to 2028. I can't think that far right now.
A lot of podcasts to be done, at least by you, between this and then. Katrina Perry, thank you so much indeed for joining me for this conversation. Most interesting, most enjoyable. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Sean. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
As always, now you can find more Insights with Sean O'Rourke on the RTE Radio Player or wherever you get your podcasts. And thank you for listening.